I was struggling for some limiting principles.
Yes, that's right. Yes, thank you. A limiting principle, well, I believe I was asked shortly before the chief's question about whether you can gain personal knowledge by looking at a video, and the state submits that you can.
How is that different, I'm sorry, from any other piece of evidence? So let's say the police officer views a pair of sneakers before the trial or views, I'm sorry, not in the context of the actual crime, but, you know, before the trial, the officer is able to view all of the evidence. Can the officer then testify with personal knowledge as to that piece of physical evidence at trial because they viewed it before the trial within the context of the trial prep?
I would say yes. Because it's just knowledge acquired through the use of your senses. And that he, if he viewed the evidence, if he's working on the case and he views the evidence, he has knowledge of what the evidence looks like. So yes. But
has that ever happened in a case before?
No, I don't know of any case where that's happened. But given that the principle is a very broad and simple proposition, if the court is concerned about having all kinds of witnesses coming in, this case doesn't require the court to go that far, because here the officer was the investigating officer. So if the court is looking for a limiting principle, it would be factual, objective narration from an officer who investigated the case, who viewed the video during the investigation. Another limiting principle would be that the court give the jury a limiting instruction before the video is played and the officer gives the narration the trial court has permitted him to give. And the limiting instruction would be somewhere along the lines of, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you're going to be viewing a video. Officer Smith will be on the stand. He'll be giving you some narration of the video. I want to let you know that his testimony is being, and this is like factual narration, is being admitted to assist you in viewing this video. But I want to remind you that you are the final arbiter of the facts and the credibility of witnesses.
So would those same principles apply to a defense investigator? So a defense investigator that has also conducted an investigation, also gone to the bank, also watched the video, could do the same exact thing with those instructions?
I don't see why not. If defendant wants to present his own witness, I don't see why he couldn't do it.
Please finish your answer.
You mentioned a 104 hearing, you're in favor of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The appellate division's suggestion is well taken, and the state fully endorses it. You, the jury, are the final arbiter of the facts, and I will instruct you in my final charge on this as well, but I want to remind you right now that you are the final arbiters of what is in this video. And then that limiting instruction would be repeated during the final instructions to the jury. So that's another limiting principle. Limiting its Rule 104 hearing, limited it to the investigator on the case. I think those three cover what the state thinks are limiting principles that the state can utilize to make sure this testimony doesn't run asunder.
The earlier question, if an investigative agent conducts a search and pursuant to a warrant, seizes 100 items in evidence, authenticates them in front of the jury, they come into evidence. Are there limits to the officer's ability at that point to describe what each item is?
I can't think of any, Your Honor.
Right. The question earlier was perception. They're looking at the exhibit and testifying about it.
If he's viewed the evidence, he has knowledge of what it looks like. So I'm not sure how he would be limited. He can describe what evidence he seized, a pair of sneakers, Adidas sneakers.
But he wouldn't be able to go further and say, and because these are black sneakers with a white stripe, I believe that these were consistent with the sneakers that were worn by the suspect during the crime.
No, I wouldn't say he could go that far. If he had personal, that was the situation before the court in Singh, where the arresting officer was allowed to testify that the sneakers defendant was wearing at the time he arrested defendant were similar to the sneakers that he saw in the surveillance video. That was proper lay opinion testimony.
Because he had been on,
because
the
he
held,
he
had
he
been
knew
on
what
the scene
they looked
and
like.
Saw them,
yes.
Right. But if this is an officer that wasn't there, had no connection, and just by virtue of conducting a search, seizing the evidence, and describing to the jury, well, these are black sneakers with a white stripe. The victim says that, you know, that's what described such sneakers, so I think these are sneakers that are similar to what the suspect was wearing.
I would say no. If he's an ID officer, he can only identify what he sees, a black pair of Adidas sneakers.
But when the video comes into play, that changes your answer.
It does. Because in Singh, the importance was the officer's personal knowledge was from the time he arrested defendant.
Right, but here, there is none of that personal knowledge, right?
I don't
and the officer is just looking at a video, which is exactly the same thing that the jury's doing.
But the officer in our case is not making any identification. He's just simply narrating factual, objective material that the jury sees along with him. It's a play-by-play, objective narration. He's not making any identification. He's
right. Not in this case, but again, there are areas where there's some dispute. And as Judge Sabatino mentioned before we took the break, with regard to whether the suspect had two fingers on the note and one finger slightly on the counter, that's subject to dispute. And that's something that the officer specifically said, in my opinion, from my observation, it looks like the suspect has two fingers on the note, as opposed to just letting the jury make a determination or letting the person who was standing right there, the bank teller, right in front of that suspect, testify to what he believed happened or what he recalled happening.
Well, with respect to whether or not Mr. Gambarotti, he was asked. He was shown three still photographs from the bank robbery.
Not the video.
He wasn't shown the video. He was shown three still photographs from the camera behind his head. And he identified from one of the pictures, I believe it was S2 or S3, he said there's two fingers on the note. So there was testimony from the bank teller that there were two fingers on the note. And as I intimated earlier in response to another question, how the officer phrased his particular answer to the narration on the bank teller putting the fingers on the note, he was very careful not to usurp or not to show to the jury that they should just be following everything he said. But that's a fact. If you look at the video, there are two fingers on the piece of paper. That's not something that's disputed.
Well,
because it shows
the absence of other parts of his hand on the counter.
That might be disputed, but the two fingers on the note, you can see it right there in the video. I submit that that's not disputed.
You're hinting at it with the answers that you're giving. Are there limiting principles as to the content of what the officer may testify to?
Yes. If the officer is being proffered to give objective narration like was done here, it has to be limited to objective facts that are not in dispute, that can be clearly discerned from the video. If the officer is being proffered to offer lay opinion testimony, meaning opinions and deductions from inferences or evidence not from the video that go beyond what's on the screen, then the state has to satisfy the requirements of Evidence Rule 701. Helpful to the jury and adequate perception. And then the trial court would address whatever specific objections the defendant would have to the state's proffer, and then the trial court would make its ruling.
And the perception for that type of testimony, based solely on viewing the video?
Yes. For the narration, yes. You can gain personal knowledge by watching the video.
So I'm a little confused because you have two categories here. One is factual testimony limited to objective facts, not in dispute. And the other is if proffered for lay opinion, if I heard you correctly, beyond the video.
Correct.
Then the state has to meet 701. What about the middle category, which would be proffered for lay opinion based on the video, which is what I believe is what happened here? The lay opinion in this case was not about some extraneous information that the officer had. It was about his opinion as to what was going on in this video.
Your Honor, the state doesn't see a mid-ground. There's either factual narration or it's in the realm of lay opinion.
I agree, but you characterize lay opinion as something that went beyond the video. But lay opinion, as in this case, could be within the four corners of the video and would still be considered lay opinion if there was an opinion element to it.
I can't think of one. But I do know, as I argued in my brief, that when the officer was permitted to testify to compare the size of the person in the video to his body size, that's lay opinion, because that goes beyond what the jurors see on the video. With respect to the narration he gave, it was all just factual. I can't think what would have been proper lay opinion testimony, aside from the body size testimony, that would have been given on the bank video. I can't think of an example.
When the officer talked about, in his opinion, the two fingers, I forget the exact language of what he said, that's improper as far as you're concerned.
Well, no, I'm saying that the court shouldn't put so much credence on how the officer explained himself, because there are two fingers on the note. It's not a disputed fact. It's right there.
So you're saying that's factual, even though he said in my opinion.
That is correct, Your Honor. The way the officer phrased himself at times, if the court recalls, sometimes he would say, it appears as if this. So he was trying to be conservative in how he expressed himself. But that doesn't mean that it's opinion, because that's a fact, because it's on the screen. He's viewing it, and the jury's viewing it. That's not
opinion.
So
what's the definition of a disputed fact? Because when I asked your adversaries, whether, for example, if someone's hand has a glove on it or does not have a glove on it, and that is very clear from the video, they all said, no, that is not an objective fact, that is an opinion. And you're saying not only is it an objective fact, but it is not disputed. Who determines whether it's disputed? If the defendant says it is disputed, I disagree that person is not wearing a glove, and I believe the person is wearing a glove, or I believe it's disputed whether the person is wearing a glove. How does one say, no, that's really not disputed? Or do you really mean like good faith dispute?
Not really. My argument is just based on what your eyes are telling you is there. If there's a dispute, I was going to say that the Rule 104 hearing could flesh these arguments out, and the trial court would decide whether the video shows a glove on the person's hand or not. And if the judge rules that yes, the officer can use that as a factual narration, if the defendant has evidence he wants to present to show that there was no glove, then he's free to do so. But I think those are issues that would be resolved at the 104 hearing.
So the judge would make a determination as between the parties about a factual dispute, which would determine whether the jury would then get to hear evidence on a factual issue that it should be making the...
It would be whether or not the officer could narrate in the manner that the state wants. And if the state wants the witness to say there's a glove on the hand, and the judge would have to watch the video, and the judge agrees with the state's that there is a glove, he would say that the officer can testify that way.
Let's take a slightly harder example where the question is, has the line blurred a little bit? And it relates to this case with the hand perhaps touching and perhaps not touching. If the state wants to say the palm touched, but the defense objects and says, no, that's far from clear, what happens at that point?
Well, again, Your Honor, I guess it depends on the nature of the evidence. If the video raises a question as to whether the hand is actually on, then the judge would rule the officer wouldn't be allowed to say it is if it's not clear that it is.
Would not be allowed to say?
Yes, because if it really is not clear, then it doesn't fit what the state is arguing as a factual narration. If it's not clear from the video, then the state wouldn't be offering it to say that it is, if it's not clear. But here, the question was on the fingers, and if you look at the video, it's clearly two fingers on the note, and the officer testified that, as did Gamparotti. So, again, issues about whether something's there or not there, those could be resolved at the 104 hearing.
Are there any practical impediments to the state retaining an expert in light of, and I'm not expecting you to know cases that weren't cited in the briefs, but let me just represent to you that there are a number of cases in the last several years, as video has proliferated, as we all know, involving specialty experts such as a video forensic examiner or video consultant. The Supreme Court of Connecticut last year authorized the use of such expert testimony to dissect and analyze complicated videos. The civil federal case brought after a George Floyd-related protest, had a similar expert retained in that, his 1983 action. There are people apparently out there that offer that expertise. So if I represent to you they exist, are there any impediments, budgetary or otherwise, that, and I'll ask the Attorney General to see that they have a reaction to, that it would prevent having competent experts do this instead of a law enforcement wearing the uniform or whatever, presenting this kind of opinion testimony to a jury?
Well, in the context of objective narration, I don't know what the field of expertise is.
I'm talking about opinion, though. When there is either dispute or, you know, there are subjective aspects. I know the opinion below talks about play-by-play. I happen to be a big sports fan. I loved Phil Rizzuto. He was play-by-play, but it always was in the Yankees' favor, okay? So play-by-play sometimes can be presented in a narrative that may not be the most objective fashion. And so the danger you have, though, is that that can occur, and why couldn't we regulate this even better with using expert reports and established 702 procedures rather than trying to shoehorn all this under Rule 701?
Well, Your Honor, again, you know, expert testimony is specific scientific specialized knowledge, and I don't know where in this
scientific, though. Mr. Shalom reminded us of that.
Well, but what's the specialized knowledge? This is a surveillance video, and either the officer is giving factual narration, or if there's some lay opinion testimony with respect to the video, it's lay opinion. I have a hard time understanding where the expertise comes in. Now, I've seen experts testify about enhancing videos. I've seen expert testimony where a video was very grainy and the expert used a specific program to enhance it. That's definitely an area of expertise. But with respect to a surveillance video, I don't know where the expert testimony comes into play.
In this very case, if a fingerprint expert were called to testify about the amount of pressure that is needed on the surface to leave a mark or not, and in presenting that testimony is commenting on the video, would that be allowable?
Yes. Yes.
So there is the option there, right?
Yes, it helps if I had a concrete example. I mean, the officer here testified to what the jury could see with him on the screen. Opinion testimony about fingerprints, whether certain surfaces are amenable to leaving prints behind. I agree. That could be an expert testimony.
And they could narrate the video as they do that. Say, what you're seeing here is the palm versus the finger.
A factual narration is not expert testimony.
Okay.
But again, if there's a dispute as to whether another portion of the hand or the palm actually touched the surface, I don't know if a fingerprinting expert would be able to say, well, as I'm looking at this video, I think the fingers, they can talk about collecting evidence, collecting these fingerprints, but in a potentially disputed issue as to whether other finger, not talking about the two on the note, as to whether other fingers or a palm, because in the video, it's not really clear whether there's another finger that touches the counter that's off of the note. So in an issue like that, I don't think an expert would be, that's for the jury to determine whether, if that is a disputed issue, that's for the jury to determine. I mean, I think the solution is letting the jury watch the video and figure it out. I understand that there are going to be times where the state wants a witness to say something. There's going to be plenty of times that the state wants to get certain evidence before the jury. But there's also plenty of times where that evidence just can't go before the jury. Whether it's undue prejudice or 404B issues, there's just times where that evidence just won't go before the jury, no matter how helpful it is either to the state or to the defense. In a scenario like this, when there's a dispute, the answer is probably just let the jury figure it out.
Well, when I answered the question about the expert, it was in the context of whether or not certain surfaces were amenable to having prints left behind.
Right.
So if there's a fact question on whether a palm touched a surface, you know, it would be an expert to say, well, this kind of surface would be amenable to leaving a print, this surface would not be amenable to leaving a print. And that was the extent of my answer. I wasn't suggesting that an expert could resolve factual issues for the jury. It was just to opine a matter that would be an area of expert testimony. Factual narration is not expert testimony. It's just narration to help the jury view the video as it's playing in court. And it can be given limiting instructions and the court's final instructions to the jury, which make it clear that they are the ones to decide what's in the video. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll address point three. In-court IDs. Again, defendant is asking for a per se rule of exclusion. The state urges the court not to go that route. This court's jurisprudence holds that each case rises or falls on its own facts.
So let's look at the facts here. The witness identified the defendant as the man in the middle at counsel table. How many people were at counsel table?
Three. He had two lawyers.
Was he of the same race as his attorneys?
I know that one of his attorneys is African-American. I don't know the race of the second attorney.
Was he dressed the same way as they were?
I don't know.
There's evidence in the record that we've gone over that the prosecutor said to the witness beforehand, the individual accused of committing the robbery was in court seated at the defense table. Under our case law, could a police officer say that to a witness prior to conducting a show up or to administering a photo array?
No, you're not supposed to suggest an answer to the witness. But
so,
in this
so why was it appropriate here for the prosecutor to pinpoint the defendant's location and then ask where he was?
Well, the question and answer that was given was one question and answer during cross of Mr. Gambarotti. So the record is very sparse on the circumstances. But it was done, the way the question was worded, it was you were told what would happen in court. So it's
here's what it is, so we don't misquote it. Question, and he informed you that the individual who was accused of committing this robbery is in court, seated at the defense table, right? Answer, yes, he did.
Yes. So it was in the context of explaining to the witness what was going to happen in court. It wasn't, and I'll cite to the court something that happened during summation, because the argument might be that the state was trying to, you know, coach the witness or lead him to an answer. When defense counsel on summation made an argument about that question and answer that he elicited, the prosecutor objected. And at a sidebar conference, he said, I'm objecting because he's inferring that I improperly coached the witness. And defense counsel said, I'm not arguing that.
I'm asking a slightly different question. Is it appropriate for prosecutors, as a general rule, to tell their witnesses precisely where the defendant is in court and where the defendant will be seated, and then ask them if they can identify the defendant in court?
I think what we know about
the social science,
yes,
and the evidence that has been presented to this court.
I think given what we know, the better practice is not to say where the defendant would be seated. But I think in this case, it was done to give the witness a heads up on what would happen in court. So maybe going forward, instead of saying the defendant would be at counsel table, the prosecutor would say he will be present in court.
Isn't that contrary to the instructions that are given law enforcement officials with respect to how to conduct identification procedures that are out of court?
Well, it would seem to be, but, you know, as all prosecutors give their witnesses some idea of what to expect in court. So to the extent that it's said, it's not being said with some nefarious purpose.
Put the motive aside.
Okay.
If it is extremely suggestive information that is being conveyed, how can one follow up on that with an identification procedure?
Well, I think that it was, again, the context is this is what you're going to see in court, and it's not necessarily telling the defendant or the witness, excuse me, that this is the person you're going to identify. So for here, the prosecutor was not trying to tell the witness, this is where you have to identify. He was just telling him, this is where defendant is going to be.
Forget,
he might have told him.
Forget all that for a minute. All this justification, what the prosecutor said. Nobody's slapping the prosecutor's hands here. The question is, under Henderson, is this identification unduly suggestive? That's the question. Is it the state's position that it's not?
The state's position is that it's inherently suggestive for an in-court identification. So it's inherently suggestive.
How about this one? Is it more than inherently? It's unduly suggestive. It would violate Henderson. It wouldn't come in.
I don't think it's unduly suggestive,
Your
Honor.
So the state's position is not, and it would come in.
Yes, it's up to the jury to resolve whether it's credible or not.
So this court in Madison said that in-court identifications are extremely suggestive.
Yes.
The National Academy of Sciences has described them as highly suggestive. Third Circuit's task force, likewise. This court with respect to out-of-court show-ups, likewise. Do you take a different position about how suggestive in-court identifications without the advance comment are?
I simply say, Your Honor, that there's inherent suggestiveness. However, whether or not the in-court identification, if one is made, in this case there was not one made, if it's reliable, that's a jury question. The jury gets detailed instructions.
Wait, I'm sorry. You said in this case there was no in-court identification made?
He did not identify defendant. He said, I'm not sure. That's essentially, I'm not sure. I'm 80, 85% sure. In fact,
I thought that's called an identification, and then he says his degree of confidence.
Well, you're saying
any time that someone says they're not 100% confident, that's not an identification.
That's not 100% identification. He wasn't sure. To me, that's like, I'm not sure. Because in fact, on cross-examination, he was shown the photograph he had selected from the photo array, was a black and white photograph, and defense counsel asked him, is this photograph of defendant? And even then, Mr. Gambarotti was not able to say that the photograph he was looking at that he had selected was of defendant, and defendant was there in the courtroom.
So if there were a court that had a rule that an in-court identification could only happen if there had previously been a positive out-of-court identification, you would say that if the out-of-court identification had only been 85% sure, that does not count as an out-of-court identification, and so there could be no in-court identification. Only 100% is the identification?
No, what I'm saying is that if he's not 100% sure, it's not a complete identification. He's not sure. He doesn't have 100% confidence level.
So you presented identification evidence in this case, correct?
I'm sorry?
You presented evidence of an identification in this
case.
Yes. Aren't we just quibbling about the significance between 80, 85, and 100%? There's no question this falls within the realm of identification parameters, right?
Yes.
So if it had happened out of court beforehand, there would have been notice provided to the defense, correct?
Yes.
And there would have been a hearing under these sort of circumstances had a comparable comment been made in advance, correct?
By comparable comment, you mean what the prosecutor said?
Identification, that this person is going to be seated right there now. Can you please make an identification, yes or no? That sort of comment is suggestive, no?
I agree that it was.
So
yes.
It would have invited a hearing, of which there was none, of course, in this case, nor was there any notice. Should there be?
Well, I guess going forward, maybe there should be, so that this could be aired out with the trial court. Here, there was none because the defendant didn't object to the in-court identification or to any testimony about the out-of-court identification procedure and the in-court identification procedure.
And, of course, we're looking to set principles going forward. So should the Henderson framework apply to situations like this, to a first-time in-court identification?
Well, I don't know if the system variables outlined in Henderson are easily transferable to an in-court identification which takes place during a trial, because it's dealing with an in-court identification from the witness on the witness stand. And there's only so much control that the court has, because you have the bench, you have the jury box, you have the defense attorney tables, and the gallery. The system variables aren't transferable to this situation. There have been suggestions in the case law to have an in-court physical lineup or photo lineup, or have the defendant sit somewhere else in the courtroom, but none of those examples seem to be very feasible.
What about what the Massachusetts court has done in Creighton?
I don't think that's a workable standard, where there's good cause. I don't know. I just think that's not a very workable standard. The test should be whether or not the witness has a basis, whether or not the meaning, whether did the witness have an ability to see? Did he have personal knowledge? Here, Mr. Gamberotti did. And if he's able to make an in-court ID, he will or he won't. And then it's up to the jury.
Tell us why, from law enforcement's perspective, the identification should wait until the time of trial, which is invariably more than a year after an incident would have taken place.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. There could be reasons that just wasn't thought to be done. There might have been reasons why it couldn't be done.
In a case like this?
Yeah, I can't answer. I don't know why the photo identification procedure didn't take place until a month before trial. I don't know why it didn't happen sooner.
I know it couldn't have happened within the first 7 months of the incident because they didn't have a suspect, right?
Right. It could have happened at some point after November 2017, but it didn't, and I don't know why it didn't. But
defendant suggests that the dearth of case law here on first-time in-court identifications reflects the fact that it is, quote, somewhat rare for a witness to be asked to make an in-court identification when he or she identified someone other than the defendant during the out-of-court procedure. Is that true?
Yes. So there are times where it's not asked. The prosecutor here could have chosen not to ask, but I believe his feeling was he wanted the jury to have all the evidence. He didn't want the state to be seen as hiding anything from the jury.
Can we infer from this record that the prosecutor reasonably expected the witness to make a positive identification in court, even though there was no formal presentation of a photograph or anything of that nature? Isn't it inferable here that the prosecutor did reasonably expect, because otherwise why even ask the question? And if that's true, shouldn't that be our standard in terms of giving notice? Reasonably expects the witness to identify.
That sounds in itself reasonable. There's a difference between looking at a two-dimensional photograph and seeing somebody in person. And here, from the record, the court can glean a little bit about the out-of-court identification procedure here from the direct, the cross, and redirect. There were six photographs. They were black and white. And he testified at trial that he had trouble during the out-of-court identification because they all looked so similar to him.
But that's in every photo array. That's the point of most photo arrays, that you put other individuals that are similar.
But what I'm saying is that there's a difference between looking at a two-dimensional photograph and seeing somebody in person who's there in person
in three-dimensional. The reasonableness that you were just referring to, is that as to whether notice should have been given or the reasonableness of conducting the proceeding for the first time?
The second. The reasonableness of asking the witness in court to make an identification. Well, there's a difference.
I'm sorry.
So again, is there any scientific evidence you can present to the court that suggests memory gets better with age?
No.
Indeed, no one suggested that during the adversarial hearing in the Henderson context. So doesn't that raise questions about the suggestiveness of this procedure, and that it's not really a fair test of memory to wait this long to ask someone?
Well, sometimes, Your Honor, it takes time to get cases to trial. It's not sometimes feasible to get an identification close to the crime. I mean, some things take time.
Again, assume good motives.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a fair test of memory in light of what the science tells us about the limits of human memory?
I think it can be, Your Honor, because, and again, it's the credibility and weight of the testimony is for the jury.
Are there any scientific evidence that supports the notion that it is reasonable to wait extended periods, year or more, before conducting an in-court first-time identification?
I don't know of any, Your Honor. I don't.
And with regard to the reasonableness of asking for the in-court identification. So in this case, there was a misidentification out of court. So I'm trying to understand what would the state put forth with regards to the reasonableness of asking for the in-court identification in court in a scenario like we have here where there was a misidentification out of court that would not allow for the in-court identification in every case. Because I know you talked about the differences between looking at a picture and seeing somebody in person. That's every identification. But in this instance, there was a misidentification beforehand. So I would think in assessing whether it's reasonable to ask for an in-court identification, there would have to be something else that happened in the intervening period between the misidentification and the point in trial where a prosecutor is going to ask for an in-court identification to show that it's reasonable to ask that question at all. Like, what here would have shown that it was reasonable from the state's perspective to ask that question when there was a misidentification where he was the same 85% sure?
Well, I think the reasonableness comes into play because the state is producing this witness at trial. He's testifying to what happened. And the state wants the jury to hear what he has. The state wants the jury to hear what he has to say.
The state wants to counter the fact that the jury is going to hear that he misidentified, that he picked somebody else pre-trial. But what makes the fact that the witness is sitting in court and telling what happened reasonable to then ask for an in-court identification when everyone knows that the identification did not happen prior to trial? And what gives the state the reason to believe that that's going to change suddenly in court, aside from the fact that there's all this suggestiveness taking place when it's an in-court identification?
Well, it goes to the fact that it's an in-court identification as opposed to looking at photographs in an array. It's an in-court, in-person identification. And whether or not the witness can or cannot make the identification is up for the witness to say.
Hold on a second there. What's the standard to determine whether the witness should be permitted to make that identification in court?
What's the legal standard? Yes, the legal standard is whether the witness had ample opportunity to view the defendant and whether or not he has testimony to offer.
Isn't the standard whether there's a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification?
Well, I draw Your Honors to its decision in 1990 in Clausel, where it said that a witness who was not able to make an out-of-court identification was able to make an in-court identification because the witness had an opportunity to view the defendant and defendant had the right to cross-examine.
So I'm asking for the current standard. We have Henderson, we have Chen. They both identify that as the legal standard to determine whether an identification proceeding can be presented to a jury. That's the standard, isn't it?
Yes.
Not whether it's reasonable, whether the state would like to present the evidence and has a good faith basis for wanting to present it. The question is how suggestive is the procedure such that it should or should not be presented in the case?
Well, I go back to what I said earlier, is that there's inherent suggestiveness with an in-court identification. But it's just something that's ineluctable. It can't be avoided. The defendant is the one on trial. So for the
but doesn't that counsel against the identification?
No, because this court has ruled that show-ups, out-of-court identification show-up procedures are inherently suggestive.
But this court specifically said, I thought, that they shouldn't take place more than 2 hours after. And this, of course, is more than 2 hours after.
Right, but this is an in-court identification.
Isn't that even worse than a show-up?
No, because this is trial testimony. This is evidence presented before the jury. It's not dealing with police encounters out of court. It's dealing with trial and witnesses and asking a witness, based upon what you saw, can you identify the robber in court? And the witness says, yes, no, maybe, I'm not sure. And then it's resolved by the jury with the Henderson instructions that the jury receives.
But you don't get to the question of instructions or cross-examination if there's a substantial risk of misidentification, and I didn't give you the verbatim standard there. That's what to do after a determination that the identification can take place.
But where is there, in other words, this is a witness who was there during the robbery. He was able to recount what happened. He had an opportunity to view. The defendant is in court. He's asked, can you identify the robber? And to suggest that that's an irreparable misidentification is it's up to the witness to say what he has to say, and then the jury resolves whether it's credible or not.
So let me come back to the earlier question I asked you earlier. If the comment and the level of suggestiveness were the same in a pretrial identification proceeding, do you think that would have been permitted to come before the jury, or would the judge have said, no, under the legal standard, that's out?
I think if it referred to an out-of-court identification procedure, the answer is no.
Meaning if the jury or not?
If I understand your question correctly, you're asking if the witness had been said something suggestive during the out-of-court identification procedure. It's supposed to be as neutral as possible. And if that had been the case, if there was a level of suggestiveness, then the trial court may not admit it, the out-of-court identification. But this is an in-court identification during trial.
So I just want to see if I understand your position. If an officer says to the victim shortly before a show up, that's the guy we know committed the crime, quite likely that doesn't come in front of the jury at all. But if the prosecutor says it moments before testimony, that does come before the jury because it's at trial?
Well, I don't think that the state's position is there's no evidence to suggest that what the witness testified to or the context to what the prosecutor said. It was a question, a leading question on cross. I don't know the circumstances to really answer your question because it's not in the record exactly how, when, or why the prosecutor said what came out on cross. It's a one question and answer, a leading question. I feel I can't answer because I don't know all the circumstances that existed for when the prosecutor said that to the witness. And it's my understanding from everything that I read that it was just designed to let him know, as we do with most of our witnesses, what they're going to see in the courtroom, where everyone sits. We do it with victims as well, so that they know they have some orientation. And as I conceded early on, perhaps going forward, prosecutors shouldn't use that language anymore, because if they're going to elicit an in-court identification, they don't want to do anything that's going to suggest an answer. State doesn't have an interest in doing anything like that. But here, it wasn't done with that in mind, and it wasn't enough, the state submits, to taint, because he wasn't 100% sure. He only said he was 80 to 85% sure, which is not 100%. And even when he looked at the photograph he picked out, he wasn't even able to say it was defendant. So I don't think that it led this witness to an answer he might not otherwise have given.
Ms. Hewlett, just to be clear, my questions aren't a suggestion of bad faith by the trial prosecutors, and I know you did not handle this at the trial level.
Okay, thank you. There should be no per se rule against an in-court identification. This court has ruled already, I know years ago, it was a long time ago, but there are other cases more recently that have not gone down this route, that there are instructions to the jury that help and guide the jury on how to gauge any in-court identification. And it just should not be a per se rule. Every case should rise or fall based upon its own facts.
Thank you. We'll hear next from Amanda Schwartz.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The Attorney General's interest in this case is to ensure that relevant, reliable, and helpful evidence is not kept from the jury because of inappropriate categorical rules. The admissibility of narration testimony and first-time in-court identifications should be determined by the trial court as gatekeeper on a case-by-case basis. Looking specifically at the narration testimony, to highlight some of the questions that have been posed already, I think some of the concerns are best addressed at the proposed rule from the appellate division decision about a Rule 104 hearing, because the questions that focus on whether some statements are pointing testimony, pointing the jury what to look at and where to look at and what frames to look at, might not be in dispute, and it would be such just objective narration testimony, and the parties could agree that that type of comment would be proper for the officer to make. But more subjective comments that would be necessary to be under a Rule 701 interpretation would be made with proper objections before the trial court to make determinations of whether that type of comment was sufficient under 701. And so these types of situations can be best dealt with at a Rule 104 hearing, where the parties come together and agree which comments are purely objective and can be used at the jury, as the Appellate Division decision opinion called that type of testimony pointing testimony, whereas the more subjective comments would get through a proper 701 analysis with the trial court acting as gatekeeper in those instances.
So to understand this more concretely in terms of this case, do you agree that the judge appropriately sustained the objection to the sergeant saying, it seems like the suspect was doing everything he could to avoid leaving behind evidence. That was objected to and sustained. Do you think that was a correct ruling?
Yes, Your Honor, I do, because that was a conclusion and a legal conclusion that was left for the jury to make. Regards to the other testimony about what his hands were doing and the questions that have been posed by this court before, if we look at the language of subsection B in 701, it says that if the witness testimony is helpful in determining a fact and issue, and in this case, a fact and issue, as highlighted by defense counsel, was whether or not fingerprints were left behind. And this was a case about misidentification, and the defense really attacked the state's case, which it has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, about whether or not the fingerprints evidence that was collected, there were seven in total, should have led to the defendant or another suspect if the person who committed the robbery was the person who left the fingerprints behind. Therefore, Sergeant Vitelli's testimony about the note and the door was just helpful testimony on how to look at the video. It still was up to the jury to view the video themselves and come to a conclusion of whether or not what Officer Vitelli testified to was in fact what happened. Judge Sabatino, your question about analogy to sports as the Appellate Division decision, the jury would be the referee in that instance. The officer is giving his opinion of what the video displayed, and then it's up to the jury to decide whether or not they accept that opinion. And the jury
is. I understand that after a law enforcement officer is introduced about his experience and his expertise and he's wearing a uniform, the jury might be more inclined to believe the law enforcement officer's opinion than, for example, the defense counsel's argument.
The jury is properly instructed that they're the ultimate arbiters of fact. They were repeatedly told that at the beginning of trial and again at the end of trial, and that it's up to them to review the evidence, and that any testimony they heard, the credibility of that testimony is up for them to weigh. And in this case, where they have the video and they watch the video and they actually watch the video during deliberations, they don't have that narration when they rewatch that video. It is up to them to watch the video and determine what that video actually shows.
But after already hearing from an officer give their opinion on what the video shows.
In this case, yes, Your Honor, but there will be other cases where, as highlighted by this court, there might be a defense investigator who might give similar testimony that says, no, his fingers or a different portion of his hand had touched the teller counter. I mean, during cross-examination, the defense counsel really highlighted that the surface was clean, the suspect touched it, and again, in closing, really emphasized that. So it was up to the jury to take all that information, as it does in every case, and determine whether or not what the evidence showed is what the video showed.
Is there any significance to the observation by the trial judge after the trial? It said in candor, you know, the first time I saw that video, I wasn't so sure about the identification. But then after hearing the testimony and so on, now I'm persuaded that because the judge had that personal reaction to it, does that possibly indicate that this kind of testimony may be too persuasive in shaping the views of jurors who aren't trained like judges to handle evidence in the same manner?
I think when it comes to identity issues, that is not before this case. The judge made sure that Officer Telly did not comment on identification, and there are specific rules, as this court has lined out, when an officer is going to identify a defendant. They need to have outside familiarity. That is clear in the case law, and that was not part of the issue. in this case. But I think that, to Your Honor's point about the helpfulness of it, is if we're going to just pause the video and just blindly tell the jury to look at it, they don't know what they're looking at. They don't know the import of the video. They don't know the import of the evidence at that point, and they have to wait to the conclusion of trial at summations to determine, oh, that's what I should have been looking at. That's what is important for me to decide the ultimate issue. And I don't think that's an appropriate time. I think the pausing and the pointing testimony especially is helpful to the jury to make, to do its job as the ultimate finders of fact.
But you and a couple of your colleagues have talked about the 104 hearing as the way in which to hash all of this out, and made a distinction between factual information that's really essentially undisputed. And the way you put it, according to my notes, is more subjective comments would be subject to the process. Why wouldn't a defense counsel, simply say, everything's contested, Your Honor? I'm not agreeing to anything. They've got the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Everything in that video, consider for right now, if we haven't started the trial, consider it contested. We're not going to agree that anything is fact in that video.
I think that might create a lengthy 104 hearing and affect the credibility of the attorney in front of the judge, because I think it was the example in the appellate division decision of because the limiting principle is that the narration cannot usurp the role of the jury. So I think if we're talking about a case where the identity of a car or with specific markings is in dispute, that the defense has every right to say that the officer cannot comment that that's the specific video car. But if the identity of the car or the location of the car is not in dispute, the trial court is likely not to entertain any argument that they're contesting that that happened. I also note that there's some comments about whether or not it would be expert testimony, but none of the observations are outside the ken of the jury. It's just lay opinion testimony that is designed to assist the jury in determining, again, I want to highlight that it's determining a fact and issue, and it was appropriately for Officer Rotelli to assist the jury in determining on whether or not fingerprints were left by the robbery suspect. And Officer Rotelli's testimony only referred to the person in the surveillance as the suspect, which this court is saying said is the proper way to present such narration. And also, I think the federal cases are instructive on this point with the personal perception, because as this court said in Sanchez, the personal perception prong is a limit on how the officer obtains that knowledge, so that they're not relying on inadmissible hearsay. An officer who rewatches a video is not relying on any inadmissible hearsay. The video is there for the jury to evaluate themselves as well. If there's no other further questions on the narration point, I'd move on to the first time in court identification. This court's eyewitness jurisprudence has made clear that bright line rules that preclude reliable or have the potential to preclude reliable eyewitness identification is not the proper procedure, that it should be a case-by-case basis that looks at the suggestibility of the identification.
Counsel, what is the AG's position on whether the Henderson system variables can be transferred directly to this in-court setting?
They're not a proper, like, they can't be carried over specifically to this. There's considerations in the Henderson factors that wouldn't be applicable to the in-court identification.
Are there system variables that should apply if the court were to create a set of factors that should apply in the in-court setting that are not in the list of Henderson system variables that are for out-of-court identifications?
It's the Attorney General's position that for the suggestibility of in-court identifications, that there is no argument that they're not suggestive, but that the test should be as indicated in Perry and the other out-of-state cases of whether the out-of-court procedure was suggestive and whether there's an independent basis for the in-court identification.
What about if you have here where the out-of-court identification didn't produce an identification?
There's still questions of whether or not that procedure was suggestive or that should still be explored by the court. And I think the true question is, like...
Sorry, so you're saying that if there's an out-of-court misidentification, but it wasn't suggestive, the witness just picked the wrong person, then that should make it more likely that an in-court identification can happen?
Yes, Your Honor. The test should be whether or not the out-of-court identification was suggestive and if there's an independent basis for the in-court identification.
Why? So, why does it matter? If the person previously identified the wrong defendant, then why would they, I'm sorry, the wrong person, why would they be better able to identify that person in court when they obviously know, even if the prosecutor doesn't say anything, unless there was a suggestion at some point about hiding the defendant someplace in the courtroom, but if no one is hiding the defendant anywhere in the courtroom, then every witness is going to know which is defense table and which is the prosecution's table, and every witness is going to know where defendant is sitting. So why is that more reliable and more likely to get in?
I'm not saying it's more likely to be reliable or get in. It's just, it's a question that should be then go to the jury. If there's no subject, if there's nothing suggestive about the identification other than being in the courtroom, a defendant has the Sixth Amendment protections of the adversarial system at that point. And so if there is a sufficient basis for the in-court identification, then the prosecutor should be allowed to ask the question, because at that moment the jury is listening to it. They have the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. They have the Sixth Amendment right to compel witnesses. One of the cases talks about the defense bringing in an expert to talk about how the science about the suggestibility of in-court identifications. There's something different between the jury being told a witness's competence level and being able to see it. I would submit that in this case, Gambarotti kept saying he was 80% sure that the defendant was at counsel table, but kept admitting that he's not sure, that it had been a while, and the jury was able to see all that, and the jury was able to see him look at a photo of somebody else and look at defendant at counsel table and still not be sure if they were the same person. So when there's no other taint besides the fact that it was in court, the adversarial system itself protects defendant from the suggestibility that is in the Henderson decision.
Go ahead, please finish your sentence.
I was just going to say that, and the ultimate weight to give to that identification is for the jury to make.
Yeah, does the AG agree with Ms. Hewlett's acknowledgement that going forward, when you have identification issues like we've got here, that prosecutors should not advise witnesses, those eyewitnesses, where the defendant will be seated?
I think that is a proper concern that the Attorney General is aware of, and I think that there are certain rights as victims of crimes, because this is not just a witness. This was the victim of the robbery, of being prepared to what to expect at trial. But if there is an issue about identification, that it might be best practice not to tell them exactly where in the courtroom, but that I don't think that should be the bright line, another categorical rule if they were told.
And do you think that would actually help, unless you were going to try to hide the defendant someplace in the courtroom and have the defendant not sit at counsel table, even if the prosecutor doesn't say, just so you know, defendant will be second one in from the left at defense counsel table? Presumably, the jury is sitting there. They see which people are standing up as the lawyers to argue. They know exactly which is defense table. How could they be confused about who the defendant is when they're in court?
I think that in the current state of, like, the pop culture and everything, I think everybody knows where the person in the courtroom is, the suspect and the defendant. I think hiding the defendant actually might raise further questions of the concern in Henderson of what a lineup is, especially given different ethnicities and races, and making sure that there's a fair representation in the gallery and whether or not victims' families are in the gallery. So I think that those are other concerns that should be considered in making that kind of determination.
So there are two ways to analyze the identification through the prism of due process, for example, where the police have conducted the identification procedure, and through the evidence-based approach that Chen speaks to when it was private action. Which should apply in a situation like this where you have an in-court identification and questioning by a prosecutor?
It would be the due process analysis. The prosecutor is definitely an actor of the state. But just because there was identification, a first-time in-court identification does not mean that due process was violated.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, just that the Attorney General emphasizes that no categorical bans on evidence should be admitted and adopted, and that everything should be on a case-by-case basis. Thank you.
Chief, one last quick question, just please, to make sure you're on the same page, as they say. Would you agree with a notice standard that if the prosecutor reasonably expects there'll be an in-court identification made, that there should be notice at that point?
Again, Your Honor, I think that notice might be something that can be discussed, but it shouldn't be an absolute bright-line rule that a prosecutor may that has to give notice, because there may be situations where the prosecutor was not planning to ask, but then sees maybe the witness has a visceral reaction to seeing defendant in the courtroom and thinks that maybe if they ask, they'll get the answer. Or there might be instances where a prosecutor asks the witness if to describe what the suspect looked like and goes, oh, by the way, they're over there. So I think that the notice requirement shouldn't be, again, a bright line determination.
If it was purely spontaneous,
yeah,
that'd be different, right? Okay, thank you.
But if it wasn't a blurt out like your last example, and instead it was a situation where the prosecutor believed there might be an identification to be had from the back and forth, wouldn't the appropriate course at that point be to go to sidebar and tell the judge, we want to ask the question, Your Honor? Let the defense raise whatever issues it might have at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. That is something that could be a procedure that is adopted. But I just want to note that in this case, the defense never objected to this identification and elicited on cross-examination all the weaknesses and really used his summations to emphasize why the in-court identification had no weight. So it's not clear that just because the prosecutor lets the defense counsel know they're going to do it, that will result in the identification not being made.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Michaels, we'll go.
I wasn't going to say anything about identification, but I wanted to just respond briefly. Anything that the defense counsel was able to accomplish through cross-examination was completely undone by the prosecutor's summation and the instructions that didn't give the jury the proper tools to assess the identification. I have one brief point I wanted to make about confrontation clause. The state is relying very heavily on Medina. This case is really different from Medina. In Medina, this court specifically held that the law enforcement officer's testimony that evidence collected after he had provided information about the evidence that he had collected didn't imply that this anonymous woman gave any information at all. So it's just a very different case factually. And I just had a couple of quick points on the video narration issue. So I agree with the Attorney General that this is lay opinion testimony. I disagree with the idea that just from viewing a video a certain number of times, this can somehow imbue someone with expertise. It's not just me saying this. This court said this in Lazo, in rejecting in Lazo, and then in the explanation this court gave in Sanchez of Lazo. So that's something that's just not consistent with this court's jurisprudence. And if you look at, for example, in Singh, what this court focused on in allowing the testimony regarding the sneakers was that the detective in that case saw the shoes on the night in question when the defendant in that case was apprehended very shortly after the robbery. And the court specifically noted that this detective had firsthand experience with the shoes, and also noted, by the way, regarding the helpfulness, that the detective said that these shoes were similar to the video, that was something that made it not invading the province of the jury. I also wanted to point out that, no pun intended, that even if you allow some kind of pointing testimony, this went so far beyond pointing testimony. This wasn't the detective saying, now I'm pausing the video, look at this quadrant of the video. This is the detective saying, here is the suspect. He has gloves on. He's not making contact with the door. So it's not just pointing something out. It's providing his opinion about what the video depicts. And the idea that the video narration is just helpful in facilitating the video to the jury suggests a neutrality that just doesn't exist here. What it's helpful to is the state in vouching for the state's theory of the case and theory of why, in this case, why there wasn't fingerprints that led to Mr. Watson, and it was also helpful to the state in bolstering the description of the teller and implying that the detective agreed with it. Also, regarding the question about the evidence that, or the testimony that I think everyone conceded on the other side was inadmissible, there's a difference between sustaining an objection and striking an objection. Sustaining an objection is forward-looking, right? But striking testimony is backwards-looking, and the judge can do either of those things, and when the judge strikes testimony, the judge has to tell the jury what is the testimony that's being stricken. So I don't think that that the idea that the judge said that evidence was sustained and didn't say anything about striking it, the jury is therefore going to realize precisely what was the testimony that the judge meant to strike but actually didn't tell the jury that he was striking. On the video narration point too, if you apply the standard, even any of these standards that the state or the attorney general have put before this court, this testimony was inadmissible. It was inadmissible even under the state's, to the extent the state gave any limiting principles, even under those limiting principles. And the last thing that I want to say about video narration is the fact that the jury asked to see the video again doesn't mean that therefore this this lay opinion testimony didn't have any effect. It just means the jury thought it was important. And of course it was important, because this was a case with very, very minimal evidence that directly implicated Mr. Watson as the robber in this case. And so for all of the reasons that I've addressed.
I just have one question.
Yes.
And I hesitate to even ask it, because
okay.
I know the hour that we're at here, but imagine the quintessential undisputed objective evidence. He wasn't wearing a glove. And assume for this, that's what I have in the back of my mind as I ask you this question. For the search agent who testifies about items that were seized from the residence and gets them in evidence, what is the analytical basis for the police officer, the detective, to be allowed to testify and identify with precision each of the items that are put in evidence?
So
to tell the jury, to give the jury fine details about the sneakers.
So this has nothing to do with this. There's no video here.
No video.
Why is
that allowed? And that's why I'm asking you, because I'm looking for the analytical distinction between the two areas.
Well, it meets 701A, which this doesn't meet, because in that case the police officer would be making whatever determination he's making about what color they are, or some scuffing or something like that, based on what he's actually seeing. I think in most cases,
but it wouldn't come in under B. It wouldn't do so under A for a video, which was crystal clear.
I'm sorry, now we're on a video. Okay. Now,
yes.
Well, I think
segueing to the video.
No, because, well, he can testify about all of the things that I've talked about already, providing the authentication, but he can't testify about what the video depicts because he did not personally perceive the things that are being depicted.
Okay.
And this is the way that this court has handled this kind of evidence for decades, and this is consistent with the way this court has always handled this sort of evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for the very fine arguments. Went a little